content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, a team of volunteer readers will be reading short science fiction stories. We call our program Science Fiction Shorts, and it will be available in podcast after the broadcast.
This is Joe Campo, Between the Lines by Wendy Nickel. We met in the pages of a book, somewhere shortly before Act Two. It wasn't my story. It wasn't his. We weren't even secondary characters. Not the best friend or the sidekick, and certainly not the villain. But we were there, on the edges, behind the lines, between the letters. Insignificant, yes, but there. We were somewhere just off page, like actors waiting in the wings, when our elbows brushed and we found one another without the slightest blush or fanfare. "You aren't a rival love interest," I asked in whispers. "Not the jealous ex." "No, I'm not. Are you?" "Not that I know of. At least, not in this volume." "Good. I'm glad." And he smiled. Our fingers brushed, touched, entwined, and from that moment on we were inseparable. We kept to ourselves, sneaking off when we weren't needed, to frolic in the margins of previously read chapters and huddle, knees touching in the spine. "How do you think it'll end?" he asked as we eavesdropped on their conversations as their story rose and fell. "I don't know," I said. I never did like endings, and with theirs would come our own. It came too soon, as I worried it would, full of tears and tragedy and the final plot twist that made everything make sense. Everything, that is, but us. "Do you think there'll be a sequel?" He gripped my hand. "If there is, I'll see you there." We kissed. Just once. And the final page turned.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Oceans of You by Pam L. Wallace. You laughed when you scooped up something from the beach. You brushed off the sand, then offered it in cupped hands. A rock, perfectly heart-shaped, except for a chip on the left side that gave it a lopsided appearance, just like your smile. "Here's my heart," you said. It had been 3 weeks, 4 days, 7.5 hours since we met. A lifetime, a second, forever. I took your heart. You pulled me into your arms, fiercely tender. The waves crashed in an iridescent green sheet, rushing to coat our feet with icy froth. And I drowned in the deep ocean blue of your eyes. You laughed when you pulled me out on the deck, pointing at the stars, your eyes alight with reflected moonlight as you told me about the mission. You were alive with excitement, gleeful at the prospect of traveling beyond our solar system, discovering new worlds, being the first. I was happy for you until I understood what it meant for us. I wanted you to stay. No, what I really wanted was for you to want to stay. I understood then that I'd never mean as much to you as the stars. Oh, I knew you loved me, but you'd love space and science and exploration your entire life, and me only the last year. You sobered when you saw my sadness, talked about the time we still had, all the things we would do, and I drowned in a tidal wave of longing. You laughed when I told you I was pregnant. For a moment, I glimpsed that look in your eyes, the one you usually reserved for the stars, and this time, it was when you were looking at me. I basked in that glow, in the feeling of complete and utter joy. Your arms around me, one hand resting on the curve of my belly. Contentment settled around me and stayed all through the pregnancy. Even though your training kept you away for long hours, it was enough that you came home with that look in your eyes, directed at me, at my growing bump, even when my belly button distended. The baby's nubbin, you called it, and you laughed. The baby came, and I saw the look in your eyes, directed into a smaller pair of deep ocean blue eyes. We named him Jason after his grandfather, and I drowned in a warm sea of contentment. You laughed when you told me all systems were go and the mission was approved. Your excitement was tempered by what it would mean for me and Jason. When you found me crying in the bedroom, you held me so tenderly. You told me you'd stay, for me, for Jason. I knew it wasn't what you wanted, but I didn't care. I needed you beside me. For Jason. No, for me. When I said, yes, stay, I watched your laughter fade, leaving your eyes a deep, dark well. I saw you looking out the window at the stars, and for the first time, your look was filled with sorrow and regret, and I drowned in waves of guilt. You laughed, subdued and quiet, at Jason's toddling, but your spark was gone. There was no joy hidden in your dark depths. You became more and more withdrawn, sneaking away to peer out the windows at the night sky, lost in dreams that didn't include me, and never had. I knew it. I really did. I didn't want to believe it. I wanted to believe that someday you'd love me more than the stars. I thought that by denying the stars to you, it would force you to see me instead. I finally realized it was only forcing you to accept second best. And that's when I told you to go. You did, with one last look of regret, running straight down to Mission Command to see if it wasn't too late. And it wasn't. Not for you. But for me and Jason, it had always been too late. I held you for every second I could, committing your face to pictures and memory, forgetting that I would soon be alone, and just rejoicing in being us, together for now. And I drowned, over and over again, in the deep, dark ocean blue of your eyes. You laughed when you left that day for the launch test. You stepped out the door, jaunty and at ease, and I waved and laughed back, forgetting myself, and just happy that you were so happy. I had finally accepted the inevitable. We still had time. I refused to count the days or the hours, living in the now. Each minute with you was my eternity. It was a good day. Jason gurgled his joy in discovering how to climb into the toy box. He clapped his hands together when the doorbell rang, toddled over to the door to gaze, wide-eyed, at the uniformed officers. I closed the door in their face, as if that could hold back the news forever, and I drowned in dark seas of despair. I heard your laughter at liftoff. The behemoth blasted upward in a shock of white vapor, and I heard you so clear, booming through the crackle of the loudspeaker, in the collective sigh from the viewers in the stands. Your wish was granted. The ashes, all that is left of you, on board the ship, destined to forever reside on alien soil, so far away from me. And yet you'll always be near. I see you everywhere, and especially in the deep, dark ocean blue of our sun's eyes. Your laughter is always with me, and I drown in it over and over again.
I'm Sonia Usach Kuhn, and I'll be reading Planning for Your Retirement by Nikki Drayden. I bet you thought you'd be enjoying your golden years, traipsing through the lush forests of Belize, admiring the Venus de Milo with your own two eyes, enjoying a game of low-grav shuffleboard on Proxima Colony. All those things you were too busy working your tail off to enjoy. Yes, your retirement is right around the corner, and fortunately, you've put yourself in quite the position. Fully funded retirement accounts, paid for housing, luxury car purchased in cash, financial freedom. Unfortunately, it seems the universe has dealt you a cruel hand. Please, don't sit up. The nurses know I'm here. They're the ones who told me about you. They know my type. No visitors, no flowers, no balloons. A nice get-well card from your stockbroker. See, you're the perfect candidate for a last-ditch procedure, a fail-safe, if you will, a chance to extend your life and enjoy the wealth you've accumulated over the years. I'm talking about a new body, one that won't betray you when you need it the most, a body with a lean physique, maybe a decade or two younger than the sack you're carrying around now, but not so young that your colleagues will suspect more than a very talented plastic surgeon. The C word? Of course not. Human cloning is illegal. All we are doing is making a backup copy of your brain and storing it in a flesh-based container that may happen to share certain physical traits with you. You're entitled to a backup copy of your memories and thoughts, are you not? There's been a legal precedent set in the matter, just like you're allowed to make a backup of copyrighted media. All you have to do is apply for a copyright on the contents of your mind, and sign this waiver, indemnifying us from any legal issues that might occur. Like what kind of issues? Well, for one, if this flesh-based container happens to escape from our storage facility and happens to strategically involve itself in various aspects of your life, well, we can't rightly be held responsible for that now, can we? Yes, I didn't think so. Unfortunately, our backup process is quite expensive, but many folks have been able to successfully take a loan from their 401ks to fund the process, or have taken out a home equity line of credit, or sold their cars and other valuable assets. Most often, all of the above. But think of your golden years spent doing the things you'd always thought there was time to do. What's that worth to you? Of course, this likely means you will need to work for several more decades to pay off the loans. You're in no shape for that right now. But I sense a miraculous recovery in your near future, do I not? Perfect. I'll get a nurse in here to do a blood draw and get started on the process. I'd love to stay and chat, but I'm afraid I'm already late for my next appointment, and I can't afford to miss one. I've got bills to pay, a load of debt to work off, and nothing but years of health in front of me. Actually, I'm not really supposed to mention this, but the commissions here are excellent. So if down the line you find yourself in need of a second job, or more likely a third, give me a call. Honestly, I could really use the referral bonus. If I'm lucky and stick to a modest budget, I'll be able to retire for a second time when I'm 123, and this time I swear I'll get the chance to enjoy it.
This is Steve Lord, and I'm reading Storytime by Laura Ann Gilman. There was a prince who lived in a broken-down castle in a broken-down land. He had no great treasures, no great armies, no great love to save him, and neither did his land. And he cursed the skies and the streams each day that had cast him to be born to this life. To be born to the poverty. How could he be a prince if he was poor? Running a country is very expensive.
Didn't he have a fairy godmother or a dragon to bring him money?
He did not.
He needs a dragon.
Does he now?
He needs a dragon and a love, because you can't just have money, you gotta have love too.
You are very wise for one so very young. The youngling made a face, nose scrunched up.
Tell me more about the poor prince.
Yes?
Please?
The prince did not wish to be a prince. It may be that he wanted to be a dragon himself, to spread great wings and fly off, to bring back treasures and perhaps a fair maiden who might come to love him.
Or eat.
Or eat, although that would only stave off his hunger for a little while.
But he wasn't a dragon, not even a little bit?
Not even a little bit.
So what happened to the prince?
Nothing happened. He stayed where he was and cursed the skies and streams and did the best he could. He fought off famine and foes. Spread himself as thin as he could, but it wasn't enough, and slowly his people starved and died.
That's not a story.
It's not?
It's not a good story.
No, perhaps it is not. How would you make it better?
He could ride off and have adventure and find a fortune.
And then who would take care of his people while he was gone?
Oh.
The youngling made another face, knuckles cracking.
Adventure could come to him with the fairy godmother who had missed his birth and wanted to make it up to him, with a big party and presents, so he'd not be poor ever again.
That would be a good story.
But it doesn't have a dragon.
No, it doesn't.
I would be his dragon.
Would you now? And what would you do if you were his dragon?
Bring him my hoard, if I had one, that is.
Knuckles dragged across a worn, scraped floor. And if you did not?
I'd find one and bring it to him, so he wouldn't have to curse any more, but could be happy and not worry about his people any more, and he could go have adventures then. That would be a proper story.
They were silent a moment, contemplating adventure.
And I'd find a love for him, too. A princess. Or another prince. Or a coal girl. Princes fall in love with coal girls, don't they?
Perhaps they do.
Do they ever fall in love with dragons?
Sometimes, in the very best stories, they do.
My name is Larry Bliss. I'll be reading One Alien's Wreckage by Mary E. Loud. Choreth's round feathered face stared down at the contents of the cryopod, and her wide copper eyes narrowed. She had been expecting to find valuable cargo for salvage. Instead, all she saw was a squirmy green-fleshed larva about the length of Choreth's upper wing. "Anything in there?" Amy called out. She was another space wreck scavenger. Usually, Choreth didn't like to share her finds, but Amy's cruiser had arrived seconds before her own at the charred remains of this shuttle, smashed into asteroid 835. So, Choreth had puffed up her breast feathers, squawked a good story about avian authority in this sector, and been relieved when Amy agreed to share the find rather than insist on her rightful claim. "It's just a larval version of the Lepidopteran aliens who owns this vessel," Choreth chuffed. "It's their kid?" Amy said, pushing Choreth aside to see the larva for herself. The pink skin between her small blue eyes creased. "Damn, an orphan now." Choreth grasped one end of the cryo chamber with her strong lower wings and said, "You want this, or can I have it? Either way, it's a heavy piece of equipment, so we should move it together. We can dump the larva out and leave it in the wreckage." "Are you kidding?" Amy said. Choreth's owlish eyes blinked. "No? I mean, it won't be dangerous to us. Look at it." Following her own advice, Choreth looked down at the helpless green caterpillar-like thing again. It kind of made her hungry. If it were smaller, say, only a talon's length long, and she had a whole bowl full of them. Choreth clacked her beak hungrily. "It'll die," Amy said. Choreth wasn't terribly familiar with human tonal communication, but Amy's voice had raised in pitch and taken on an irritating quality. "If you're worried about cruelty," Choreth conceded, raising a talon toward the larva, "I suppose I can kill it now so it won't suffer from starvation." Before Choreth could close her claws on the larva, Amy's pink-skinned fingers darted out and scooped it up. She cradled the caterpillar-like creature in her arms, rocking it and making little cooing sounds to it. "Such smooth skin," Amy said. Looking up at Choreth, she asked, Is this really a larval version of the aliens we saw crushed in the cockpit? It's going to grow huge, colorful wings like that? Chorif nodded, unsure what was happening here. Amazing, Amy breathed, staring down at the caterpillar creature in her arms again. You're going to be beautiful, she said. Was the human actually talking to the infant larva? Amazing, Chorif thought. Apparently, the human valued this alien baby. How odd. Suddenly, a thought struck Chorif. Hey, I'll trade you the larva for the cryopod. As addled as the human seemed by the presence of an alien baby, she still shot Chorif a look that meant she could see right through that gambit. No doing. You were going to leave it here, so I get it for free. Trade something else for the cryo chamber. Chorif grumbled. She was really off her game today. But at least she wasn't as crazy as this human. Amy wandered out of the crashed ship's cargo back, back to the docking port, and onto her own ship, where she called up a view screen and immediately sent a vid message to Crossroads Station, all the while bouncing the squirming larva on her hip. This is Salvager 41, and I found a survivor in the wreckage on asteroid 835, an infant. Could you search the databases and send me any information about whether anyone's looking for this infant? Anyone I can return it to? Any information about custody, really. Thanks and out. Chorif chittered. She'd followed the human out of curiosity, and now it all made sense. You're going to hold it for ransom? She asked, admiringly. Before Amy could answer, the viewscreen lit up with an image of a reptilian alien. Salvager 41, we've checked the records, and the crashed shuttle on asteroid 835 was registered as Lyca-4, a species that doesn't have a centralized representation in the expansion. They show up as traders and cargo haulers occasionally, but there's no one for us to contact regarding this matter. If you bring the infant to us, we can enroll it in the fosterage. Otherwise, under salvage rights, you can claim it as your own. However, you will be expected to pass several examinations regarding your fitness as an adoptive parent to an alternate species before the arrangement can be made permanent. Over and out. Chorif chuckled at how the human's plan had backfired on her. The upward curve to her fleshy lips was clearly an expression of her disappointment. I think I'll name you Lilalai, Amy said.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Science Fiction Shorts. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.